Jeff here?
Jeff's not here.
Okay. Good afternoon, everybody. This is Jeannie, and welcome to the Let's Grill Jeannie call. It is just 1 o'clock right now, so we can start off with a couple of announcements, and then I will tell you how to ask questions on the call. So the first announcement is UP9 was a huge success, and thank you to everyone who came out to participate and those that watched us online. You can sign up for next year's event, which is UP2018, by calling the office at 781-878-7114. What is happening? Jeff is heading for Denver, Colorado for his immersion bus tour this weekend, and the road crew is heading out to Columbus, Ohio for our Multifamily Millions Boot Camp. Steve Clements runs that, and he did a fabulous job at UP9, by the way. Upcoming events, Managing the Manager, September 15, 16, and 17, and it's in Rockland. If you plan on attending and didn't turn in your confirmation form, fill it out and return it to the office so we're aware who's coming and who isn't. Laurie Marine Hines and myself will be teaching that event on September 15, 16, and 17. Here's a few high fives. Anthony Platt closed the 4 unit. Anita Jones closing on her first 16 units on Friday. A lot of hard work went into that, and she's so excited. Michael and Vivian Kenyon closing on 212 units. And Jimmy Stewart is now at a record high of 1,457 units. Congratulations to all of them. So if you would like to ask a question, you can press star zero and the operator will queue you up to ask a question. So do we have an operator on the line?
Yes, you do, Jeannie. Hi, this is Lillian.
Okay.
I'll be the operator.
How are you? Good talking to you again.
I'm doing great. Thank you.
Is
thank
anybody
you.
Waiting?
No, not at the moment. Ladies and gentlemen, if you just join us and would like to ask a question, please press star zero. Star zero for questions, please. Thank you.
Okay, Jeff's not back yet, but I have Jermaine on the call. Jermaine, you want to say anything?
I just want to say, Jeannie, that UP9 was incredible, and that we couldn't have done it without students who were fired up and pumped up and just gave a lot of energy. So it was a fantastic event. And you guys should be definitely giving yourselves a round of applause because you did a wonderful job this weekend. So made our lives a lot easier. So
yes, it did. Okay, so the first question. I have a question I've been wondering about. Is the Holy Trinity guideline for us to achieve when analyzing properties a must? Or are there some instances where 2 out of the 3 numbers will suffice, at least 12% cash and cash return, 1.6 debt coverage ratio, and an 8% cap rate? The problem is if you lower your cash on cash return in any way, you're still committing to the investors. You're going to pay them an 8% preferred rate of return. And if you come in at 11%, it's coming out of you and your sponsors carve out of the deal. So I mean, the investors are going to get their carve out no matter what. It's just if you want to shave off some money off of yours, then you can fall below. But that 8% to start with affords you 30 to 35% of the deal. So I mean, why take away from you if you stay with that guideline or if you tell the investors that you're going to start paying them 8% preferred rate of return once you stabilize and hit the 12% cash-on-cash return? You could do that. It might take you 2 or 3 months, so they may get a little bit less, but you don't want to cut out some of your portion of the ownership. Hope that explains it. And that was asked by AJ Tudor. Any questions yet, operator?
No, Jeannie, no questions at the moment.
Okie doke. This question, the next question comes from Danny Trujillo. He's from Denver, Colorado. The sponsorship package includes 9 DVDs. I'm nearly through it. At what point do I contact, choose, or work with a sponsor? Thanks for the help from you and Jeannie. I'm sure I'll be contacting you both again. So the reason why we have you do this sponsor quiz is to make sure that you're aware of what the sponsor's role is. Their sole responsibility is to qualify you for the mortgage. And a lot of people think the sponsor's going to put up all the money, they're going to, you know, put up the earnest money, put up the down payment. That's not at all true. Some of them may help you put up money, but most of them are there to show their net worth and their liquidity to the bank so that you get that lower interest rate and you get the loan that you're going after. So what point should you contact us? When you got a deal. If you have the sponsorship package and you haven't completed all of the DVDs, contact us when you have a deal and let us know so we can give you some phone numbers to work with, because you're going to have to put in an offer on the property, and without having the financials, the broker may not give you the rent rolls, the year-to-date operating expenses, and the P&L for the last 2 years without knowing somebody is in the deal who can qualify to close. The next question is from Aditya. When sending out investor profile forms, is it okay if I use my company name even if I have not registered it as an LLC yet? Yes, you can use the name because you are going to register it as an LLC, but you got to make sure it's available. Because if you're using it and people are planning to be a part of your property and you haven't registered your LLC yet, and somebody comes in and takes that LLC, then you're sort of backpedaling. That's the only caution I would have on that one. Here's another question from Melody Tan from Seattle, Washington. Is there any upside to not taking a 5% acquisition fee? Oh, of course there is, because you may be able to offer more on the property to get the deal. Say there's a bidding war going on. Say you go from 5 to 3, that allows you to still get your cash-on-cash return at 12 and offer a little bit more on the property, because the ultimate reason is to get the property, not the acquisition fee. Nice to have it, but I'd rather get the property and maybe get, you know, 1% acquisition fee rather than put it in as 5%, never get a property because you're pricing yourself out of the ball game. Anything you'd like to add to these, Jermaine?
Well, you're saying it perfectly. There's nothing I'm going to say to add to that. You are amazing. You're on fire today, Jeannie, so keep it up.
These kind of come naturally. I've heard them a time or two over the last 19 years of working here. So this next question comes from Kathy Simpson. One of the highlights at the UP9 was the Shark Tank presentations. I thought the sharks were great and the presenters were good. My question is, what elements do you think some of the presenters were missing that may have cost them from getting a deal with a shark? Is there a magic word or two that everyone hears and says they want to do the deal? I just want to make it easier for me in the future. Okay. The shocks I handpicked, so I know the kind of questions they are going to ask. If you don't know your numbers, don't present. If you're not prepared, don't present. If you come to the table and you've got a property and it's under LOI, you better know every single answer that they're going to ask you. And if you know them, there were several presenters that you could tell they were coached and they knew exactly what to say. They had all the answers, good or bad. The Sharks loved them. And almost all of them will get funded. There was one or two, you could see they have not been in coaching. They were unprepared, even though they presented okay. They didn't have all the answers and they didn't structure the deal properly because they were missing the whole point. To get a sponsor or a shock to invest with you, you better know that property inside and outside or don't present. And that's what I think that is the magic. If you know that property, you know every question they're going to ask because you've studied it, you'll get funded. If the property makes sense, the sharks will come on board. If the property doesn't make sense because you don't know it and you haven't delivered the information to them properly, you're not going to get it. It's like confusion. It runs havoc on people. And some people confuse the sharks because they didn't know their homework. It was just something they couldn't do. Any questions yet, operator?
Yes, our first question comes from Jose. Jose, please go ahead.
Hi, Jeannie and Jermaine. Jose Rivera from San Antonio, Texas. How are you doing, guys?
Good.
Hello, Jose.
How are you doing?
Doing great. I just wanted to take just a few seconds just to thank you for the event. It was awesome. It was my first one. I don't plan to be out of any other one in the future. It was just simply great. And it was great to see you guys and meet Jermaine in person finally. I bother him on the phone every time, so it was good to put a face with the name. It was a great experience. I definitely, it was a milestone for me being able to meet so many people and do so much networking in such a small, only 3 days, but it was so many good people to meet and we have very good rapport with a lot of people, so we might be very close to land deals pretty soon. So thank you for that.
That's awesome, Jose.
Thank you. And I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say we're happy that you enjoyed it. We have some things we're going to improve for next year, so it'll be much more streamlined and the networking will be better. And we might take the exhibitors out of the room they're in and put them out in the lobby there so everybody gets a chance to visit with them and see what they have to offer. So we got some plans for next year.
Awesome. Yeah, now that you mentioned that, one of the things that I got a similar feedback from, it was the speed networking session was a little bit kind of hard to understand the other people and hear the ring and the bell.
Yep. Next year that will be much better. We're going to fix that. And we have some, we've already have a plan in place. We addressed that this morning of things that we need to tackle, and that was one of them.
Okay, awesome. And then my question would be, from the weekend, I do have a contact that is she's a high-end position in a property management company. Is there a way, or what do I need to do in order to maybe evaluate the possibility of have her as a presenter from the property management side, like there were other presenters there?
Most definitely you could do that.
Do I talk to you, call you later and talk that
up? Yep, you want to take that offline because you don't want to give out your contact.
Sure,
because other people may have not gotten that.
Okay, we'll do that. Okay. Then. I'll touch base with you. Thank you so much, and thank you, Jermaine.
Sounds
have a great day.
You too. Jermaine makes an excellent cop, doesn't he? Any others, operator?
Okay. Yes. Up next we have Darren. Darren, please go ahead.
Hello, Jeannie. This is Darren, also in San Antonio, and thank you so much for this weekend. It was absolutely amazing. I'm still reeling from it and still very busy contacting everyone I met, so it was just an amazing experience. And I want to first of all thank you, all of you and everyone listening, for everything you guys did and making it a great weekend. It was just amazing.
Good. I'm glad.
Welcome.
Thank you very much. And and to Jose that was just on, hey, how's it going, partner? We've been practicing our Bostonian for the last few days.
Is that what we sound like?
Well, I don't know. It's exaggerated, of course. This is a Brit trying his hand at Bostonian,
right.
Of course. But I have a question. I've kind of hit the ground running. I just met with a finder. Somebody who's been out looking for apartments wants to get into the business himself. How would we, if we find people, you know, not brokers, but actual, you know, individuals who want to, like, hit the ground running, be bird dogs, if you like, how would we compensate people like that? What kind of scenarios are possible for compensating someone who, you know, runs around, finds apartment buildings, knows the numbers, you know, at least on a basic level, and can bring us deals?
I would put them on the manager's side for a small carve-out. I'd probably give them 5% carve-out of the deal rather than pay them X amount of dollars in cash, because if they're part of your deal and it goes well, they're going to flood you and give you all the deals. If you're just going to give them a couple thousand dollars finding a deal, they're going to find it for everybody in the world, and you'll be like in last place.
Right. Thank
you
for that.
So if you give them a carve out of the deal, you're going to own them. They're not going anywhere.
Excellent. Excellent. Thank you very much for that, Jeannie.
You're welcome.
And have a good rest of your day, and thank you again for this weekend.
You also,
okay.
Anytime you want to practice Boston, just give us a call.
I'll do that. Might have to drive my car to the bathroom.
Yeah.
you sound pretty
well,
good.
The car was pretty good. I like that.
Have a wonderful rest of your day. Lovely
you
talking
also.
With you.
You also.
Okay.
Okay, and we don't have any further questions at the moment. I did want to announce for those who joined us, if you want to ask a question, please press star zero for questions, please. Thank you.
Okay, my next question comes from Mark Robinson from Montclair, New Jersey. My question is short and sweet. When do I get a sponsor involved? Is it before I have the deal under contract, or after the deal is under contract, or is it when I sign the LOI? Well, it's a good idea to haul them in right from the beginning and let them help you iron out all of the difficulties that you're going to experience with the broker right from the beginning. If they're telling you they want to sponsor your deals, bring them in. If you get a deal and you don't have a sponsor yet, then that's when you'll need them to get the financials from the broker. Most of the time the broker says, well, I want somebody showing proof of funds or showing that they have the net worth equal to the mortgage amount before they give you the rent rolls, the year-to-date operating expenses, and the P&L for 2 years. So as soon as possible, I would say, and sometimes you may take more than one sponsor in, because maybe it's a $20 million deal and your sponsor can only qualify for $10 million, take another sponsor in that can qualify for another $10 million. So that's, Jermaine, you got anything else to add?
Like I said, Jeannie, you are on fire today.
Well, long lost Jeff Lindell just showed up. Let's see if he has something to say. Say hi, Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
Did you have a good lunch, buddy?
Yes. Yep. Went over to my father, dropped off the cornhole boards for Dave's big clam bake for the staff on Friday. So, unfortunately, he always has lobster when I am away. So, I'll be in Denver this weekend.
Okay. So, my next question comes from Joe S., who I'm not sure that is. What was the best advice you gave to a student this weekend at the UP9? Can you share it on the call? The best advice I gave to people was to take their business cards, write on the back of them what they got or something to remember them by, and then bring me the stack and I'll separate it by who they should reach out to first. That was the best advice I had. Jermaine, what about you?
I think the best advice that I gave somebody this weekend when they were asking me about the best way to contact brokers or the best way to find the deals, I just told them, like I've been hearing for the last 7 years, is just smile and dial. Smile and dial as many brokers as you can in the area that you're looking to invest in, and hopefully somebody will bite and give you what you need. So that was the best advice that I gave somebody this weekend.
That was good. And Jeffrey, what about you?
Oh, I gave so much great advice this weekend. Let me see. What did I give out? Someone was closing a deal, okay, and they did the lease audit. So they were just verifying the security deposit amount. And I told them, make sure, like, if there's any new leases come in between the 3-4 days prior to closing, make sure that they add that total to their own security so that they don't owe the tenants. Make sure that that gets added to the total they think they're going to get, and they'll be all set. So that was one of the advices I gave to them.
Well,
what else did I give out? Yeah. I actually had someone from an immersion that came up and told me about the great advice that I gave him about when he does a T12. And I told him, like, whenever you do T12s, you always count back just to make sure it is a trailing 12. For those that don't know what a T12 is, it's basically the profit and loss statement. And if we're going to look for the T12 for July, right, it actually go from July back 12 months. And so I told him to count them, right? And he said he counted them, and it was actually 13 months. So imagine plugging those numbers into your underwriting template that are per year. It makes it look like a totally great deal, you know? So that was like another little bit of advice that I gave out. What else?
I think whenever you're in a situation like that, having close to 1,000 people in one place, collect cards, organize later, and reach out. It's going to take you a while to put them all in a spreadsheet, but know the people that really hit upon you that you liked and want part of your team. You got to make notes, and you got to right away connect with them, maybe start a meetup group in a certain area. Just stay in contact with these people because they're going to push you forward, and they're going to hold you accountable. Not only is your coach going to do that, but these people that are relying on you to be the leader are going to push you to be the star that you are supposed to be.
I told people, like, make sure that they visit a property during, like, different times of the day. So because it might change at night, you know. It could be like that's where, like, everyone comes together and they throw huge parties. If you visit during the daytime, you might get a chance to talk to some tenants, you know. And if you talk to the tenants, find out if they like it. What do they think of the property manager? What do they think of the maintenance people? You can get, like, a lot of good ideas when you visit the property at night.
I also tell them, like, make sure they check out every unit and when they're doing the inspection, because the, mm-hmm. it's the unit that you don't go into is going to be the one that the hoarder lives in, you know, the one that is, like, filled to the top with everything. So,
well, there's nightmares. You could see mold in that one unit that none of the other ones had, and that's the start of a problem.
Another one was make sure that they check for public, like, works projects, because they take over the property, and next thing you know, that project got approved, right, and they start digging out the front of the entranceway into that apartment complex. It's going to not only, like, affect you with lease-up people trying to lease up, but also when you're trying to get potential new tenants in there, because they're just going to drive around. They're going to go to the property that isn't being worked on right now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yep. See, Jeannie, I was giving, like, out a lot of advice out there.
Boy, I'm impressed.
It was like, someone was in the market, right, where they had the tennis court, and it was being unused. So they had the tennis court sitting right in the middle of, like, on the property. So I told him to make a bok park out of it. You know what a bok park is?
Mm-hmm.
A dog park. Make a dog park out of it. You know, it's like put the money that they were going to use to repair that tennis court into something that they can actually get income from. They can start charging a pet fee, and they have, like, a nice little bok park, put the dogs and walk around, the seats there, stuff like that. So you want to take an amenity that's not being used and create something that you can use it, put there, and, like, make some money off of it, too. Those are a few.
Well,
I can think of others, you know. It was a long weekend. I think that was only on Friday. I'll try to think of things that, like, good advice I gave out on Saturday and Sunday.
Okay, we'll jump
in. Sunday, like, I told everyone to have a safe flight, so that was, like, good advice, right?
That's something you can control, right?
Yeah.
All right, operator, do you have anybody else?
Yes, we actually have Reggie with a question. Reggie, please go ahead.
Hi, Jean and Jermaine. How you guys doing?
Good. Jeff's
good.
On the line, too.
Oh, hi, Jeff.
Got any good advice for us, Reggie?
Do I have any good advice for you?
Yeah.
Keep doing what you're doing, because you guys are really rocking, and I'm really learning a lot in this program. So just keep doing what you're doing.
That's awesome.
Okay. Basically, I have two questions. The first question is regarding a sponsor. I know you guys say you get a sponsor, but who is a sponsor? How do I get a sponsor? I mean, what's the process of, because I don't know any sponsors. How do you find a sponsor?
So we have a sponsorship boot camp. And if you get sponsorship as part of your program with us and you're wanting to get a sponsor, you could have gone to the boot camp, which is November 17, 18, and 19 in Boston. You will physically sit with 15 different sponsors. But if you need one immediately, then you call me up on the phone. You tell me how much the property is going for and where it's located. This is after you've done your test and got your certification. And the test is listening to all the DVDs. Then you get certified, and then I can give you out a sponsor. They basically qualify you for the mortgage amount. They're the reason why you're going to get the deal, because the bank's not going to give you a loan on a $10 million property that's got a loan amount of $8 million unless you have the net worth. I mean, if you have half of that and your sponsor has half of that, you can co-sponsor. But the sponsor basically qualifies you for the mortgage, and in some cases they will help with the earnest money deposit. And if they don't, I know people that do earnest money deposits that I can afford you. And the broker's not going to give you all the numbers on the property unless he knows somebody in the deal can close it, because he's tired of giving this information for free and never getting paid on it. And then the people go to their regular brokers and they close the deals without them. So that's basically it. But the loan will not be given to you unless you can qualify for the mortgage and have up to 6 months liquidity of mortgage payments. That's what the sponsor is required.
Okay, so the sponsor has a limit, as do I. So based upon both of our limits, that is just based upon how much we can get. The sponsors, he can qualify for $10 million. I can do $5 million, so $15
some
million
can do more. Some can do more.
Okay.
But say you find a $30 or $40 million deal, I mean, you might require two or three sponsors in on the deal. So in that case, you're going to take 50% of the deal for the manager's side, which includes your sponsors, and 50% to the investor side.
Okay. Get it. Okay, I have a second question. This might be more applicable to Jeff because this came from my immersion training, and I still have a question. It's called the capital expenditures. There's the above the line and below the line. Could you explain that?
So it's if the capex expenditure is above the line, that means it's actually coming out of the net operating income. So you can consider it being like the tenth operating expense. So when you figure out what your NOI is, you subtract out the capex. So now when you're calculating your cash on cash return, which is the NOI minus debt service to get your cash flow, and then you take your cash flow, you divide it by your acquisition costs, and you come up with the percentage. Your percentage is going to be lower because you're taking it out. So basically, when you calculate on cash on cash return above the line, it's going to be lower. Now, if it's below the line, that means it's not being calculated into the NOI at all. So your cash on cash return is going to be higher. But the true projection is because the bank is requiring you every month to take out that CapEx out of it, right? So, and that's coming from the rent. So your true projections are going to be lower. So when you calculate it above the line, which we have in our underwriting template too, we're doing it the right way.
Yeah.
Okay, so
a lot of people put their CapEx figures in there, and they put them down at the minimum, say, $300 a door. But say when you're doing your walkthrough, you know for a fact there's certain things that really are going to have to be done, and the bank hasn't been out there to give you a mortgage estimate. You better also be putting money into CapEx, your closing costs other, which is the repair money that you're going to get from your investors to do the repairs. Because if the bank comes in and withholds all the CapEx money that you've set aside, we're going to get the money to do the work to submit it to the bank to get a reimbursement from them. You're going to have to do a capital call with your investors, or you're going to have to come out of pocket. So if you have the money in your closing costs other, you've raised that from your investors, and it's available and in the bank when you're ready to go and, you know, put lipstick on the property and maybe put laminate flooring and granite countertops. You've got the money there to get this work done.
Okay. So you want it above the line when you're buying and below the line when you're selling? I know it's one of those, I think. When you're buying,
right on. That's exactly what you want to do.
Yeah.
Because when you're selling, because the value is based on the NOI, right?
The value is based
on the NOI divided by the cap rate. So if your NOI, if it's below the line, is going to be higher. So that means your value is going to be higher.
Right, exactly.
But you might get flubbed up if they're a Lindahl student. They know this rule.
That's right, because they're educated.
Think about it. They're educated.
Yeah, that's very good to know. It really is. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, y'all. I appreciate it.
You're welcome. Sure. Nice talking to you, Reggie.
Okay, up next we have Alicia. Alicia, please go ahead.
Oh, it's my favorite gal from Southern California.
Hey, you.
Hi,
How
cutie pie.
Hi.
Or should I say your husband's the cutie pie?
I got so lucky.
He is cute.
Well, we had a great time, and it was, gosh, it was just great reconnecting with everybody, and we met a lot of new friends. There sure seemed to be a lot of people from California this time around. I don't know if that was.
Yep, it was.
But didn't notice.
Well, that's why. That's why there was so much energy. Yeah, that's why there's so much energy in the room.
So,
you know. Because they're all asleep, you know, because of the time change.
Yeah, we just all have to figure out something for retirement. It's so expensive over here.
Yeah.
So my question is, what is the advantage, disadvantage, or does it all depend on the loan, of assuming a loan from a piece of property?
Well, I like the assumption process because... And the key is to make sure it can be assumed again. So if the interest rate all around is, you know, running around 5.5-6%, and the assumption loan is 4%, that's a win-win. It's a win-win. It costs you an extra point for the loan, typically for the originator as well as assuming it. But you can get it, and you'll have to raise a little bit more money because depending on how long they held the original loan, unless it was interest only, if they held the original loan for a couple of years, so now say it's a $5 million property and the assumption's like $2.5 million, you may have to come out of pocket or raise $2.5 million, but you're getting that lower interest rate. You're on a 30-year note, but maybe your due date is 7 years, and you want to make sure that your loan can be assumed again. So your guide in your mind is you're keeping it for 3.5 years so that you can sell it, and your new people will have it for 3.5 years. But I like the assumptions, and the reason I don't like them is it takes a lot longer to close just because they have to do title searches and all of that stuff, make sure there's no liens, and, you know, it can be hairy, and it can take up to 6 months to close. But when you
do that long?
Okay. Yeah, it can take 6 months to close it.
So is the seller responsible for the amount of interest on the assumable loan, is that the bank's responsibility? This loan in particular is 6%. So I'm not feeling that it's a real good deal.
But 6% is higher than what it is right now. Well, how many years remains on it?
I don't know that question. I don't know that answer.
Well,
I'm
you
just
need
starting
to know
to
that.
Okay.
Because if you're taking a, say it was 4%, and the going rate right around now is around 4.5 to 4.8. So if it was 4%, that's a win for you. 6% could be clouded if there's only a couple of years left. The reason why these people do assumptions is because they have a high prepayment penalty, and they're unwilling to pay that prepayment penalty. So at 6%, I would probably say you do your numbers, try to get a new loan, and put your put the prepayment penalty maybe in other closing costs so that you can get a new loan at a 4% or 4.5%.
Another thing you have to consider too is like you're gonna have to come up with a difference between what they owe on the loan and what you're buying in that. And I think it's Fannie Mae that has it. I believe there's two tiers, okay? So between eight and 10 years or above, right? They'll do something. They might do up to like between 75% to 80% leverage on what's left. So you have to come up with a difference. If it's like around 7 years, it's 65%. And if it's less than five, they won't do it. They won't do secondary leverage. And like Jeannie said, you're going to have to raise all the money.
Oh, okay. Okay. Okay, so there's a lot of unknowns still for me that I need to figure out.
But I did an assumption loan, and it worked out fine for us.
Uh-huh.
So, you know, it depends on the circumstances, and we can take this offline and talk about it more if you like. But it can be a win-win.
Okay, that would be great. I'll find out the unknowns that I have right now, and then if you don't mind, I'll give you a call. And
and make sure you ask, can it be assumed again? If you assume it, can it be assumed again, and how many years are left on the existing note?
Okay. That's the key. All right, great. Well, thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I felt really good about just to recap on the Boston. That was probably one of the most fantastic events I've been through so far. I reconnected with a lot of people and got really a bonding going on. So it's good. It was, so thank you all.
That's
for
great,
that.
Alicia.
And all your hard work. That was just fantastic. Absolutely fantastic.
All right. Great
seeing
you guys.
Okay. You guys take care.
You too.
Bye-bye.
Okay, up next we have Dawn. Dawn, please go ahead.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, Dawn. How are you?
Oh, good. I've got a few questions. One of them being, you mentioned something, a certificate for the sponsors. So we need to obtain that by going through all the DVDs and the course, and then
we
get a certificate from you. Is that right? We contact you,
let
you know we've gone through them. How does that work?
There's a test inside the end disc that you have to take to make sure you listen to them. It's not a hard test. You know, it tells us that you've gone through.
I created the test. It's very difficult, so you better get
started. Oh, my gosh. If not difficult, probably confusing.
No, it's not confusing either. And then once you get your certificate, you know, you're off and running.
Okay. And so that's absolute must before a sponsor can be getting, even if we were at the event this weekend and we met somebody that said they'll sponsor, then they still want to see that certificate, right?
No. No, that's you want to get a sponsor from me.
Oh, got it.
Not if you got your own sponsor.
Okay.
But it's smart if you do it, Dawn.
Oh,
it's
sure.
Smart
no, definitely.
If you do it.
Right. Yeah. And then also, too, you mentioned the sponsor split. And then normally before, like we talked in the immersion training, was that, say, 75% for the investors and 25% for the sponsor and the person putting it together for the acquisition.
Well, I would never do a 25-75 because I know 100% I'm going to need a sponsor. So the minimum I would do is 30 and give 70.
Right, Dawn. Look at your notes. I said if you're in the sponsorship program and it's Jeannie says always underwrite at 30%.
Yep, 30 35. If you're coming in at above 12 cash on cash return, you can certainly go to 30 or even 33.
Like Larry Bird?
Larry Bird. Don't go to 25 because you've got to share that with your sponsor. So you're doing all of this work for 12.5%. I don't like it.
Yeah. Okay, well, that's and then you had said if you bring in more sponsors, then you need to go 50-50. So were you talking 50% investors and 50% the sponsors?
Yes,
okay.
Yep.
Okay, and then still with doing that, then everything obviously still needs to meet the Holy Trinity then, right?
Of course.
Yep. Okay. And then another question I have would be that I had spoke with somebody and I wasn't sure that I liked their answer this weekend as far as bringing cash investors on. When do you actually really start plugging away for those? Is it before or after you actually go through the property? Because once you put your numbers together and you start getting people interested in it meets the Holy Trinity, then what, when you go through the property and then you realize, well, I'm going to need to add some money for repairs or something, that's going to change your numbers, you're going to need to adjust things, or am I just reading too much into that?
So number one, you need to be calculating interest every day from this day forward. You have no property, you still have to percolate interest that people are interested in what you're doing and the types of deals that you're working on. Now, when you go to a property and you see the numbers initially that come in with the Holy Trinity numbers, but you haven't done your walkthrough or your due diligence or any of that stuff, you cannot take any money into your bank account without your syndication documents. You need an operating agreement, a private placement memorandum. You need a subscription agreement and a questionnaire. You got to have an EIN number for your LLC of the property, not yours individually, that you're going to manage through. Of an LLC of the property. So it's, say the property is now Southfield and you're going to make it Parkway. So you're going to have Parkway LLC and then you're going to have an EIN number of that property. So you can't take a single penny into the bank until you have an LLC of the property and you have the syndication documents going on.
Right, but you will have gone through the property at that time then and got your final numbers then,
right.
Correct.
So
when you're just trying to feed people the information and show them what their return's going to be. So then if you do have people interested, then at that point you would have to go back to them and say, well, we had to adjust the numbers.
Actually, I wouldn't even tell them the returns. I would tell them what your model is. And we strive to find properties that meet this criteria. But I would never say, oh, this is what they're looking at right now. But, you know, it might change after we do our walkthrough, you know. I wouldn't do that. That's confusing people.
Right.
I would tell them what you strive to reach, the 12%, and you would be willing to give your investors an 8% preferred rate of return before you take a penny so that you're pretty clear. But I would never give them numbers before you've done your due diligence on the property.
Okay.
Because a lot of people put the property packages out there and they look great, and then you go there and you say, where's the property I saw on these papers? They don't even look good.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. And then the managers or the owners tell the management company, just fill it up with any month-to-month person you want so that we can sell the property and it looks that much better. But if you're a Lindahl student and you know the difference, and you know to look at actual rent rolls, you can see this. It's like a blatant thing that, you know, these people don't even live here. They've just plunked in there, and you take over. There's a mass exodus going on, and how are you going to strive to reach the 8% you committed to your investors? And when are you going to get any cash flow? Those are the things I would think about.
Right. Now, when it comes to the sponsors as well, what are they expecting? We know what the cash investors are expecting. So what is it that they're expecting for the sponsorship?
It's always up to the sponsors. Some are more lenient than others, but I would always plan on half of your half. That's what I would plan on. If you could do better, great. If you can't, at least you know you're giving up half of your half.
Right. I was just thinking when the other sponsor comes in, so you, if they were
it's
looking
a three-way
for
thing.
Each,
It's a three-way thing then.
Okay. All right, well, thank you very much. I will let
someone else
continue. Otherwise, I could just kind of keep you on here.
All right, John.
Yes, I guess.
Yeah, Dawn Kerr has questions, always.
Yes, well, you know, that's how you become an expert.
That's true. All right.
All right, thanks all. Had a great
week. You're welcome.
Okay, up next we have Darren. Darren, please go ahead.
It's Darren again. Hello.
Hi,
can you hear me?
Yep. Yep.
I'm good. I'm actually better than before. I've learned a lot in the meantime. I had a couple of questions. We've been talking about your sponsor. We've been talking about raising your 25% or 20 or 25%, depending on your LTV, from your investors. But what about initial raising of funds? Because you can't take money, from what I've understood, until you have a PPM. But a lot of times, if you're putting a property under contract for earnest money, what options do you have for that? How would you advise people? Because if you find an investor to help put up the earnest money until you've started accumulating some funds to do that, can you take investment from somebody for earnest money without having a PPM? And what kind of potential scenarios do you have there?
Well, earnest money deposits are similar to hard money, but a little bit less, and it's more safe for them, so they're apt to charge you less interest than a hard money lender. And most of them work off of a PPM themselves. That's how they run their business. Dave is going to be doing earnest money deposits in the very near future, so you could come to us. I don't know what the interest rate will be, but we will manage that, and you know there will always be earnest money here for you. But I personally took a promissory note on our property from one of the people that wanted to be part of it. So instead of borrowing the money under my name, I took a promissory note from them in the name of the property. They put up the earnest money deposit and the due diligence funds. And then the day we closed, we paid that back plus 20% interest because they had faith in us that we were going to close. And they also came in as an investor as well.
Okay.
So a promissory note is like a loan. It's like a 90-day loan that you took from somebody and paid them interest on it.
So in that way, you avoid having to have the PPM already in place.
Exactly.
Gotcha. The other question I had is probably a question I'm sure has been asked before, but how do you determine when you're looking at a property? Because as I'm looking at properties, some of them I'm thinking, wow, the great strategy for this one would be to hold it for 3 years, and then once you've got your NOI up and your value of the property up, then to refinance, take out the cash, and maybe keep the property and then have that cash to invest in another property. Others may be better long-term holds. How do you determine your exit strategy? What are some good pointers for that?
Well, number one, it depends on the people you have in your property. Are they coming into it thinking it's a long-term hold, or are they coming into it thinking it's a three-year hold? You're going to pay them back their money, and they're going to go and be able to put it into something else. It all depends on the people that you're attracting into your property. Because the last thing you want to do is say, oh, we're going to keep it for 3 years, then put it on the market and sell it. And they could be thinking, geez, you know, here it is 5 years or 6 years, and we haven't sold the property, and my money is still stuck in there. Ask me how I know these things, because it's happened. And then you're constantly deferring questions because it wasn't the right time to sell, and in the best interests of the investors, you have to make those decisions. Some of them are living in the real world and understand this, but a lot of people, they get their head in a cloud and they're just saying, well, you said 3 years. Yeah, well, do you want to make a profit or do you want to lose money? If we hold it another year, it's going to correct itself and get better. So some people just don't understand that. So it just depends on the investors you have in your deal and what you portrayed to them in the beginning.
So it sounds like it's prudent to, I was going to say it's very prudent then to, yeah, it's prudent to educate your investors then right from the get-go, you know, for potential scenarios. Yeah.
Yeah, you want to have conference calls. You want to let them know what's going on and what you're seeing in the marketplace and what you're hearing so that they can say, you know, you're the ultimate decision maker, you and your sponsor, but they have to know that you're working for them to protect their money, not to make more money. You're trying to protect their money from dwindling or from not getting the committed 22% annualized rate of return that you originally committed. Understood?
Right. Thank you very much, Jeannie.
You're welcome. Jeff, did you want to add something? Jermaine, anybody?
I was just curious to say you are on fire again. I was just going to tell you that. I actually learned some things, so. Keep it up, Jeannie. I'm like, you're on a roll. More questions. We need more questions. She's on a roll today.
I still have three I have to go through, but I'm going to wait for the operator to finish hers.
Okay, up next we have Paul. Paul, please go ahead.
Okay. Hi, this is Paul Schellett. Thanks for all the great information.
Yeah.
And I just wanted to throw in another factor in the question about assuming a loan. So depending on where the old loan is in its amortization schedule, if the payments that, or the portion of the payment that goes towards principal increases over the life of the loan. So if you have a 4.5% interest rate, as an example, as your new loan, if you were to go out and get one, versus like the 6% loan, which was given as the example, if the 6% loan is in the range of being 14 years old or so, there, at that point, the principal would be greater. Even though you're paying a higher payment, the amount, or the, another way of saying it, is that the amount that's going towards the interest, which is going to the bank, not towards you, so it's essentially, you know, not a benefit to you, the interest portion would be lower on the 6% loan in roughly the 14-year age time range than getting the better sounding 4.5%, but you're paying the amortization schedule, and the higher, you know, the first payment has the highest interest, and then it's slowly goes down over time.
Yeah.
So that's just another factor to throw in there along with the 1% points that you might pay on a new loan and then the 6 months or the additional time it might take to close the deal, that sort of thing. But it's part of the amortization schedule that you can throw together in Excel, and then you can kind of do the trade-off benefit, like run the new loan and the first payment at a certain interest rate. The interest might be $5,000 per $1 million financed. Then you take that $5,000 payments, you take the old loan, and you see where is it in its amortization schedule. And if the interest payment is lower than $5,000 on that, you know, if you're in payment 175 of this old loan that you're going to assume, the interest might be lower overall. So just another.
It sounds to me like Paul's a mortgage originator, are you?
Well, I had a finance background, and I've been refinancing my own mortgages over time, so then I got into doing all this analysis. But so it comes into play with.
So everybody needs to talk to Paul.
Yeah.
Well, that's very good. That was explained very well. Thank you, Paul.
All right, well, take care. Talk to you guys later.
You too. operator must be collecting names because there's
Oh,
silence.
We're going to take one more call, and she's setting them up.
And I got one.
Okay.
Three. I got three. Yep.
Up next, we have Brandon. Brandon, please go ahead.
Hello, hello.
Hi.
Hey, Brandon.
Hi, Brandon Schmidt from Denver.
It's great to meet you this weekend.
Yeah, it's great. Last event, well done. Great staff. I like all your minions running around in red as opposed to yellow.
Yeah.
That was fun.
The red shirts.
But the red shirts, yeah, I like them. But, yeah, so I'm looking at this property. The numbers up front don't look good as is. Let me actually pull these up. There's about a 7.2 cash on cash, DCR at 1.5, and cap rate 7. But the value play here is adding 16 to 30 new units on the property because there's an abundance of parking on the property at the moment. So that's a value play. So I want to get your opinion. Is it okay to buy at bad numbers in the event of getting good numbers after the value add?
Well, I would answer it this way, and then we'll put it out to Jeff and Jermaine. If you have a property that is somewhat less than shiny right now, but you know in a 6 month to 1 year period that it's going to overshadow any low cash on cash return and it's going to like scream a great deal, I would do two sets of underwriting, one with what it is right this minute and how you want to buy it, and one with what you're going to make it, so that you can share that with the investors that come into your deal and say, yes, we're going to be sluggish on cash return probably for 6 months to a year, but boy, are you going to start getting a bang after that. And then as long as they know what the plan is, they'll come in. And they will wait it out because that's what we did on our property. We waited 6 months to start paying them the cash on cash return. But instead of starting at 8, we jumped it right up the ladder and they started at 10. So everybody was thrilled, but they knew
Great.
Going into it. Anything
gotcha,
to
okay.
add, Jeff or Jermaine?
Well, I'd add, like, so is it. So those 16 units, are they down units or they have to be developed?
They would be developed. And this kind of leading into my second question, they would be modular construction.
Okay.
So the price for construction would probably be like 30 grand a unit. And these units listed at the sale price now are 179. So there's
wow.
huge upside. For this
oh,
modular
yeah.
home construction.
Yeah. And how quickly could they get them built?
So I'm not sure how quickly they could build them, but installation could be as little as 2 weeks. So, for instance, I watched this video on their website. They built a 240-unit complex in 40 days.
Wow.
So the construction goes in really quick. Now the planning and design, I don't know how long. But I think within that, it would fall within that 6 to 1 year period that you alluded to, Jeannie.
Yeah. So, of course, Colorado is pretty seasonal. So you got to make sure that you're buying at the right time of the year so you can forecast that out. But
mm-hmm.
it sounds good. It sounds like it could be a win-win.
Great, great. Awesome. And so when I do the underwriting for the second part or the additions, am I adding it? So for instance, let's say it's a 50 unit and I'm adding 16 unit. Do I underwrite it as a 66 or do the underwriting as a 16 unit with like the construction costs?
You could do it both ways and see how the numbers come in. Do it both ways.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Ultimately, you're going to have a 66 unit, but if you do it both ways, then you're seeing which one is most beneficial.
Mm-hmm. Okay. And then last question, the certificate training that you guys pushed at the event, where could I find that online in the Mastery website?
It is not ready yet. Did you already get it as part of your Mastery? You're going to have to wait a few weeks for us to, because there's four different presenters that are completely finished, and we still have to edit some of the mumbles and things like that to make it perfect. But once it's done, you'll see it up there.
Okay, yeah, I thought that program was excellent, so I'm thrilled to get started.
Yeah, I was in on all of their speaking. Eric Stewart was remarkable. Kim Taylor was a breeze. Laurie and Bob, theirs was lengthier, and there were some hiccups, but once they got in a groove. So there was some editing that needed to be done.
Yeah, I totally understand. I was a professor at a college for 4 years, so I understand the curriculum development. But nonetheless, hey, thank you so much for your answers and the awesome event last weekend, and we'll be in touch.
Excellent. Okay, so I guess I'm going to ask these questions, and then we're going to call it a day. So this is from Cassie Houston from Phoenix, Arizona. What is the difference between the Private Money Boot Camp and the Perfect Your Pitch that Dave was presenting at UP9? The Private Money Boot Camp gives you the criteria for the SEC attorneys, what's okay, what isn't okay. We do go over a little bit about your pitch there, but the one with Dave is about knowing what to say, when to say it, and how to say it. It's a totally different thing. In other words, the private money is the education part of it, and perfect your pitch is making sure that you are saying what you need to say to get the money to come in. Hope that explains that, Cassie. And the next one is from Kenny Holmes. Being a new investor, what type of property should I be finding? I know the criteria, BC properties in BC areas, but are there any other criteria I need to be aware of? I would try to find a property that has a motivated seller and at the price point that you're comfortable with. So if you're comfortable with $1 million or $2 million, or comfortable with $5 million, go for those types of properties. And go for ones that don't need a lot of deferred maintenance. So maybe a C+ or B- would be right up your alley. That's my take on it. And then this is from Noelle McCoy, Janice's daughter. She's a beautiful girl. She had a striking black and yellow dress on the last day. Striking girl. She should be a model. Great UP9 event. I met a ton of wonderful people. Thank you very much to the RE Mentor staff for putting on a fantastic event. I really enjoyed it. Oh, I guess it wasn't a question there. It was just a compliment. Okay, I'm done. How about you guys?
I'm done.
Taco, you did a fantastic job.
Taco Tuesday. Let's go get some tacos.
So next week, Dave will be back with you guys, and it probably will be on Tuesday at 1 o'clock. And I look forward to 2 weeks from now. And thank you for all of you for being on the call. Thank you, operator, for being so great. And we'll see you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye.